zur Debatte. Dokumentierte Vielfalt hören. Der Podcast der Katholischen Akademie in Bayern.
Good evening, everyone. I apologize for speaking in English. German and Germany are things I love. I'm Italian. I'm just from the other side of the border, from Lombardia. But I think my accent, my Italian accent, which you can already hear when I speak English, would become really interesting when I speak German. So bear with me. I'll speak English. I'll try to speak slowly. If there is anything that remains unclear, just feel free to come back to it in discussion. I'm extremely grateful to my hosts. It's a tremendous honor and pleasure to be here. The masterclass experience has been fabulous for me, thanks to the amazing students that have participated in it. So I thank all of them. Some of them are here. I thank the organizers again for having given me the opportunity to have this group of students here and to spend this beautiful time at the Academy, which, as I was saying to Caterina today, it's a real place of peace and tranquility and intellectual concentration. So I loved my time here. Thank you for having me. So today I want to raise a question which is very much debated both in Anglo-America but also in Europe, and it's a question that might sound very academic. So the question is, what's ancient about ancient philosophy today? The question might sound academic, but is actually very important when we think about the education of our children, the investments that our universities make in making appointments of new professors, when we think about the money that the state invests in research and so on and so forth. So I think it's very important as citizens of this world of today to reflect on what we think the intellectual priorities of our schools, of our universities, of our governments should be. And here, I just want to put forward some thoughts to consider together. I will also give you my point of view, and I look forward in discussion to hear what you all think about it. History of philosophy? Just say no. Don't even think about it. Just say no. And this is a phrase that was written on the door of a very famous philosopher, American philosopher, Jill Harman, in the late 80s in Princeton University, in a philosophy department. So from his perspective, it's absolutely imperative that we reject history of philosophy. It's a bad thing. And at that time, he was not an isolated voice. There was a debate, and the debate was very heated. Not only in the philosophy department at Princeton or the Princeton University, but generally the profession in academia. People were wondering, should we or should we not include the history of philosophy among the disciplines that we research and we study and we teach? More specifically, the question is the study of the history of philosophy detrimental or beneficial for training young philosophical minds? And the question is very, not only a question of the 80s, it's a question that's very present in academia today too. So to give you an example, the American philosopher Michael De La Rocca uses very strong terms to talk about the perception that people have about the study of the history of philosophy. And now I'm quoting. He says, "The phenomenon that I seek to understand better is what I see as analytical philosophy's apparently widespread indifference to, neglect of, or disdain for the history of philosophy and the study of the history of philosophy." So very strong negative words. And then he says, "My worry is that in many quarters of analytical philosophy, the study of the history of philosophy is merely tolerated. It is perhaps required, but only as a background to the real action in philosophy. And from this contemporary perspective, the study of the history of philosophy has, at best, a second-class status." So it is someone speaking today, in 2020, and worrying that his colleagues are not appreciating the value of the history of philosophy. So the worry, the debate is not something from the 80s only, it's something of today too. And what I want to say, it is actually really interesting. It's a timeless debate in some sense, because even at the beginning of Western philosophy, as far as we know about the beginning of Western philosophy, some of the early Greeks were looking at their predecessors, so their history of philosophy, and some of them were not. So some started from zero, and some started looking backwards. And we know famously Aristotle is a person that cared for the history of philosophy. So he was reporting and discussing the views of his predecessors, and this not because he had antiquarian reasons. So it's not that he wanted to collect his views of the past and put them in an archaeological museum. He was discussing these views to show how he was doing better than his predecessors. So he had an implicit understanding that his predecessors and himself were actually doing the same thing, only that, typical of Aristotle, he was doing it better. So these remarks are just to say that the question of the value of the history of philosophy is a timeless question. It is as old as philosophy itself, and is still controversial today, not just specifically in one particular department, but in academia in general. So I want to start from the negative perspective. Why should we not study the history of philosophy? Well, one argument that has been given against the study of the history of philosophy is by Quine, again, famous American philosopher, who compares philosophy as science and derives from that comparison reasons not to study the history of philosophy. So now I'm quoting from Quine. He writes, "Science and the history of science appeal to very different tempers. As an advance in science resolves an obscurity, a tangle, a complexity, an inelegance that the scientist then gratefully dismisses and forgets. Historian of science tries instead to recapture the very tangles, confusions, and obscurities from which the scientist is so eager to free himself." End of quote. So what's the point here? So Quine is saying, look, you know, when we do science, we're very happy to make progress. And when we have made progress, we don't go back. We don't look back, because that's the meaning of progress, that, you know, we advance. And when we advance, we don't care about, you know, the fact that before we had not solved the problem. So it is what scientists do, and mutatis mutandis is what philosophers should do. So when the philosophers of the present have made progress in relation to the philosophers of the past, so why should they look back? It makes no sense. And Quine was very influential, not only as a philosopher, so lots of our younger students here will know about Quine, but Quine was very influential on academic politics as well. So at his time, history of philosophy was relegated outside the philosophy departments in many places into newly built history of ideas. Department, classes, professorships. So there was not more history of philosophy, it was history of ideas, another thing, you know. So the implicit idea that Quine has, and many have, is that history of philosophy is not useful. I want to emphasize this word, it's not useful. It's like, you know, would you study a book written by a doctor of the previous century in order to become a good doctor? Of course not. That book's not useful to you. You may have it in the library, you know, as a nice thing to have, but you wouldn't learn medicine from that. So the idea is that there is something antiquated, there is something ancient about the history of philosophy, something dusty about the history of philosophy. And this is about history of philosophy in general, but of course with ancient philosophy, it's even worse, because these people are so old, you know, these old philosophers that are really far away from the progress we've made today. So what I want to consider here with you is three ways of answering the question of what is ancient about ancient philosophy. So I really ask you to think about it in your mind. What would you say if I asked you what is ancient about ancient philosophy? And while you think about it, I want to tell you that there are three possible answers that, and all of them have been defended in the literature. So some people say there is nothing antiquated in the history of philosophy. The past is always present. The past is as alive as the present, so nothing ancient. not the ancient, but the ancient philosophy. Some other people, on the other hand, say everything is ancient about ancient philosophy. It's like another world. They speak another language there, literally, you know. And so there is an enormous divide between the past and the present. And then some people say, well, there is something that is antiquated or ancient about ancient philosophy, but not all of it. So we just need to consider exactly what is ancient about ancient philosophy. And I want to tell you, I'm going to be there with that group of people. So I think it is true that there is something ancient that is not anymore useful to us, but I think there is a lot that still is important to us. I don't want to say useful, but important. So let's start from the extreme view, according to which there is nothing ancient about ancient philosophy. So I don't know, does anybody in this group think that there is nothing ancient about ancient philosophy? Nobody wants to raise their hands if they... Oh, one person, that's good, I like that. Anybody else? No, well, another one, Julia. Yeah, okay, nothing ancient about ancient philosophy. So why would you hold this view? So if you were to develop an argument to convince other people, what would you say? So you think about it, and meantime, I give you an argument that has been given by the very same philosopher, De La Rocca, that I already mentioned, who worries about the second-rate status of the history of philosophy in academia. So De La Rocca thinks that this negativity that we feel for the history of philosophy is not always existed. It exists in a particular context at a particular time. So maybe you picked up already in the quotation that I read that he speaks about analytical philosophy circles. So it's not all philosophers, but only those who have an analytical approach to philosophy that think that history of philosophy is ancient. And why does he think that it is the analytical philosophers that have a problem with the history of philosophy? Well, because he thinks that analytical philosophers have three core beliefs, and if you have these three core beliefs, you're going to dislike the history of philosophy. So I'm giving you now the three core beliefs, and you can check if in your mind you believe in them or not. So the first is realism. So that is the assumption that there is a real world out there. Like there are things out there. You're real people. You're not just projections of my mind. You're real people in a real world. There is a real world independently of any philosophical theory about it. Second belief is the belief in intuition or common sense. So it's the idea that we should follow our intuitions and our common sense in order to start developing philosophical theories. So philosophical theories can maybe at the end become very weird, very strange, but it should start from the way we speak, from the way we think, from like lay people, from the great public, so to speak, from the everyday intuitions we have about the world. So that's second belief. Third belief is what is called discreteness. So it's a belief that everything that exists exists as disconnected. Disconnected in the sense of horizontally disconnected, but also diachronically disconnected. So there is no necessary connection between anything and anything else. Everything is contingently related. It's like a heap of sand. It's just contingently related. There is no necessary connection between things. So De La Rocca thinks that analytic philosophers believe in these three ideas, and because they believe in these three ideas, they dislike the history of philosophy. Why? First, because if there is a world that exists independently of us and independently from your theories, there is nothing that guarantees that our theories connect to that world. So it's like a form of skepticism, you know, if there is a real world, how do we know that we really connect with that world, philosophically speaking? Secondly, if intuitions and common sense are good guides for doing philosophy, a lot of philosophical theories of the past are really not sensible, they're very strange, so we should not look at them because they don't follow any intuitive way of thinking. And thirdly, is if everything is unconnected, theories are unconnected too, so they're not related in any necessary way. So there is no connection between what I think about essentialism, for example, what Aristotle thought about essentialism. It's just contingently that we use the same word, but there is no reason to go back to the past because it has no real connection with the present. So whether you agree or not that these are the three characteristic features of analytic philosophy, for the sake of argument, now the situation is this. If you think that these are three features of analytic philosophy and they determine the despise of the history of philosophy, you have two options. Reject analytical philosophy, so just reject all of that, or accept analytic philosophy and try to work with it towards the appreciation of the history of philosophy. So what De La Rocca does is that he accepts these three ideas, but he still defends the value of the history of philosophy, and he defends it in a really interesting way. So I'm going to say it briefly, but if you're curious about more details, you can ask me in discussion. So his key idea is the following. He thinks that there should be no distinction between what is meaningful and what is meaningless. So we have no reason to distinguish the meaningful from the meaningless. And now this, I'm sure, sounds crazy. Like when you speak to your neighbors, you say something meaningful to them, and if you said something meaningless, they will never talk to you again, right? You know. So it seems strange to say that there is no distinction between the meaningful and non-meaningful. But De La Rocca has a very interesting philosophical, metaphysical justification for that. So he says, well, if something what we say is meaningful, there need to be something that makes it meaningful. So there is some sort of relation between something and something else. Something makes something else meaningful. But if there is a relation between a thing and what and the meaningful speech about it, then we have a relation. And now here is the trick. Relations are regressive. So you have A and B, you connect them with a relation, but then you need a relation connecting A and the relation, and then this relation and B, and then you need more relations connecting all these things, and that goes on in an infinite regress. So De La Rocca says, if you believe that there is a distinction between the meaningful and the non-meaningful, and that the meaningful is made meaningful by some relation to something else, you've lost the game because you're in this regress of relations, which itself is nonsensible. So you have lost it. So he says we should abandon this distinction between the meaningful and non-meaningful. And therefore, when we do philosophy, we should just take everything into account, you know, whatever is meaningful and whatever maybe is not meaningful. So everything becomes always relevant to philosophy. And these statements are quite interesting. So he says, without relations, we cannot any longer explain what makes something meaningful or not meaningful. Therefore, if we cannot identify a meaning-making relation, then if there is to be meaning at all, then all is meaning. So if you reject the distinction between meaningful and non-meaningful, everything is meaningful, which implies, according to him, and I'm quoting, all texts become permanently relevant to philosophy, permanently alive. To view philosophy thus is to see the past of philosophy and endlessly alive in its present. End of quote. So I want to say, let's think about it. Okay, so De La Rocca has, you know, holds the view that history of philosophy is important and is relevant to doing philosophy today. But he gets to that conclusion in a very strange way. And so then I'm asking you, would you be willing to buy the argument for the sake of the conclusion, or you think the argument is too, as we say in English, bonkers, for supporting that conclusion? And I just leave it to you to just think what you think. But in his mind, basically, there is no more distinction between history of philosophy and philosophy. You just mesh them together, do them together. And that is an affirmation, very emphatically, of the value of history of philosophy. As I say, it's a positive claim, which comes with a big price if you buy this argument. But that's it. I mean, you know, it's a view. Some people hold this view, and I want you to have it in your mind for when we discuss them. On the other hand, there is the opposite group. So De La Rocca says nothing is antiquated in the history of philosophy. The opposite group says everything is antiquated in the history of philosophy. Don't touch it, I mean, basically. So the people who think that everything is antiquated in the history of philosophy have two different ways of thinking about it. So some people say, okay, everything is antiquated in the history of philosophy, and that's a good reason to separate history of philosophy from philosophy, because history of philosophy is not philosophy, it's just history. It's another branch of history. So yes, we should move the philosophers, the philosophers study history of philosophy, we should move them to another department, the history department. So, you know, they can do what they do. It's just that we should not call it philosophy, we should just call it history and just move them there. And that's a position that some people have taken. History of philosophy is not philosophy. So there is a value to it, but it's not philosophical value. On the other hand, there are those who say that exactly for this reason, it's bad to teach history of philosophy to our students in philosophy because we are teaching them the wrong thing. We are teaching them history. We're not teaching them philosophy. And for those in this group that are Italian, or even for those who are not Italian but want to have a range of views that's not just Anglo-American, there is the Italian philosopher Massimo Mugnai, who recently published a book whose title is, in Italian, come non insegnare la filosofia. So his book argues that if you want to teach philosophy, you should not teach history of philosophy. If you teach history of philosophy, you're not teaching philosophy to your students, right? So even the Italians are against the history of philosophy. Like, that's a lot, because we have a strong tradition. So not all Italians, but is a representative. On the other hand, in the same group of people who think that everything is antiquated about the history of philosophy, there are those who take a positive approach and they say, yes, everything in the history of philosophy is antiquated, but that's good because therefore the history of philosophy becomes a touchstone, so a way of measuring the views of the present. Like these people of the past had very different views from the views we have today, and so we can break orthodoxy of today by seeing that there are great people of the past thinking differently. So these ancient people help us to go out of the mainstream. So I give you a concrete example. A lot of philosophers today, I don't know in this group, but believe in physicalism, and so they think everything is physical. There is no mind, there is no spirit, there is no God. And a lot of students are thinking that way too, because that's mainstream in philosophy. But we know that Plato, for example, taught that there is a soul that is in the body like a captain of a ship. So if you feel that you don't like physicalism, but you're a bit shy because all your friends believe in it, you can think, okay, Plato, who is a giant philosopher, didn't believe in physicalism, so here is a good friend I can have, a philosophical good friend from the past that can support my non-popular view, anti-physicalism view. So in other words, people like Williams, who is a British philosopher, by the way, say history of philosophy is about views of the past, but these views of the past are really important today because they give us alternatives. So, you know, we don't follow the trend, we don't go for what is fashionable. And here is a quotation from Bernard Williams. So he says, to justify its existence, the history of philosophy must maintain a historical distance from the present, and it must do this in terms that sustain its identity as philosophy. It is just to the extent that it can indeed be useful, because it is just to this extent that it can help us to deploy ideas of the past in order to understand our own. So William says, we cannot mix history of philosophy and philosophy. De La Rocca is wrong. There is a difference, and this difference is important. The distance between the past and the present is important because it allows us to look at the past and find alternatives to the philosophical fashions of the present. And some other philosophers are even more extreme. For example, another philosopher unfortunately passed away prematurely, Maria Rosa Antoniazza, had even written that we should teach the history of philosophy because that is has a anti-establishment potential. So it just helps our students to become you know, more creative, more innovative, more original, more independent from the fashion. So she thinks it's a must, it's not an option to study the history of philosophy. Insofar as we recognize it as different, we cannot mesh it with the present, because if we mesh it with the present, we don't gain that mirror that the history of philosophy gives us, and that can give us a different perspective on who we are. So, we have looked at the people who say there is nothing ancient about ancient philosophy, and people who say everything is ancient about ancient philosophy. But I am sure you know the story of, how do you say this in German? Goldlocken und die drei Bären? Goldilocks and the three bears? Yeah? People know the story. So how is the story? It's a little girl that goes to the forest and finds a house, and she goes in and she finds like this bowl of soup is too big, this other is too small, but here is just right middle one. And then she goes, she sits on the chair, too big, too small, middle one, and she goes to bed, too big, too small, middle one, and then she discovers that house of bears, you know, there's a daddy and mommy and then the baby bear that is in the middle. So just to make you laugh a little, but to say that there is an intermediate position. There are people who believe that something is antiquated in the history of philosophy, but not all of it. So we should not go the two extremes. And if something is antiquated in the history of philosophy and something not, is not, so what we should do is to try to work with the history of philosophy, incorporating it in doing philosophy today. So now the game becomes interesting, right? You know, how is it that we work with the history of philosophy to make it relevant to us today? And there are different ways of doing it. So one way of doing it, I call that the fellow travelers approach. So like the ancients are people that, like us, are taking a journey. The journey is towards truth, and we're taking this journey together, only that they've come up to a point, like, you know, in the Olympics when you're running, there is someone who runs up to this point and then you get the baton and you run forward, right? So the idea is that it's a simple idea that we stand on the shoulders of giants. So we and the ancients have the same objective, namely discover truth about certain philosophical questions. And the ancients have done this much, and we stand on top of them and we do a bit more, and then the next generation will do a bit more. So the idea is that we walk along the same path as our predecessors, and we go from where they arrived, we go forward. Now, there are a lot of assumptions. This might sound nice, you know, and quite intuitive, but there are a lot of assumptions there. So I ask you, what is it that guarantees that we're actually taking the same journey? I mean, it sounds good, but is it true that we're taking the same journey as like Plato or like Kant or whatever? And the same journey as the really ancient, such as the early Greek philosophers. So there is discussion on this topic, and the best, I think, position that I know of is that of a Swiss philosopher, Jonathan Barnes, who thinks that we know that we're doing the same journey as these ancient guys, and we know that because if we talk to them, we actually speak the same language. Now, that might sound strange, like I speak, I don't know, Italian, English, and French, but not German. You know, these guys were speaking, I don't know, ancient Greek or Latin. How can he say that we speak the same language? But what he means is that there is a universal language, a language of logic. And that language we all have in common qua human beings, no matter when we lived. So he thinks that we can approach these ancient thinkers through the code of logic, so we translate their words, their theories into logical theories, and then we can talk to them because we too speak the language of logic. So for reasons of time, I'm not going to read too much of what Barnes has written, but his idea is that we read these ancient texts as logical arguments. We try to find out if there are missing steps in the argument, we try to supply the missing steps, and then we get to the conclusion and we check if the conclusion is a good one. So we treat these texts from antiquity as if they were geometrical, mathematical proofs. And like, we can do mathematics, like, you know, like the ancients were doing mathematics, so we can do that. And that puts us on the same journey as the ancients. But Again, this might sound good, but there are objections you can think about. So I don't know if you have them already in your mind, but one common objection to this approach is that it is anachronistic. So, you know, it doesn't take into account that the ancient Greeks not only spoke Greek, they had a lot of cultural assumptions different from our own, and therefore it's wrong to flatten the historical difference. So the criticism here is anachronism. But there is another one that is it's very debated, at least in Anglo-America, and you can tell me if it is debated in Germany too. This other issue is the following. There are some ancient texts that can be translated more easily into logic. So I give you examples like the famous Parmenides or Zeno. You know, the Zeno paradoxes, a lot of people know them. You know, they're very popular because they're easily translated into logical language. But there are ancient texts that are really difficult to translate into logic. And for me, Plotinus is very difficult to translate into first-order logic. So the problem is that if we read these ancient texts, trying to translate them into logical terms, we have a bias. We're going to prefer the text that we can more easily translate. And so we create a canon of what is important from the past based on how well it is translatable into contemporary logic. And whatever is not easily encodable, we just don't care about it. So this is something that a lot of people are discussing. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Oxford, most of my career in Oxford. And for example, there, you know, the courses in ancient philosophy are only about Plato and Aristotle. And there is a little bit of early Greek philosophy, but almost none because that's certainly a kind of biased choice, right? You know, so you may think two things at this point. You might think maybe it's good to have a biased choice. Maybe it's not good to read everything. Maybe we should make a selection. So the principle of selecting is not a bad principle as long as it is done in the good way. And maybe logic is a good way. Or you may be thinking, no, we should actually read a lot else. And so personally, I'm interested in the early Christians. So they have been treated as theologians and they're not taught in philosophy departments. So I'm thinking of like Gregory of Nyssa, Basil, and Gregory of Nazianzus. These guys are not studied in philosophy departments because philosophers think that these are like theologians and so we shouldn't care about them and their language cannot be translated easily into logic. But they are, I think, philosophers. They were educated as philosophers. They have a lot to say that is philosophically interesting. And so I'm in favor of expanding the canon. But I think the expansion has to be based on good principles. So we should not have it too narrow, but we should not have it without criteria. So that's one way we can work with the ancients. So we can think of them as fellow travelers. Another way is the way that I describe with the metaphor. So it's the metaphor of a mine. And ancient ideas is like golden nuggets. So you go in a mine, there's a lot of dirt, but you find some golden bits, okay? So ancient philosophers are like mines. We read their texts and we find golden bits. And we're not committed to take everything out of the mine, we only take the golden bits. So like we read Aristotle and there are some things of Aristotle we really like, for example, essentialism, but we don't like what he thinks about women, slavery, and so on and so forth. So we leave that, like the dirt in the mine. We just take the good bits. And the metaphor of the golden nuggets is also good for a reason, because not only it indicates that we consider only some parts of ancient philosophy valuable, but we also find them malleable, like gold. So you take a piece of gold, you can do a ring, you can do, I don't know, earrings, you can do a necklace, whatever. You know, you take these ancient ideas and you shape them as you want them. And that's what we can do with ancient ideas. So forget what is antiquated and keep what is good and just work with it to do what we want. And here I brought a quote from a German philosopher I really admire here in Munich, so Christoph Rapp, who describes this way of doing things. And I'm quoting now. It's a quotation in English because he wrote a paper in English. The idea is that philosophers let themselves be inspired by certain ancient puzzles or arguments, even if it turns out that the solutions envisaged by Plato or Aristotle themselves are not satisfying. End of quote. So there are some things that are good there, not all things are good there, so you take the good bits out and you get inspired by these good bits. And this is a very popular approach actually in philosophy today. There is a current of analytic metaphysics that calls itself Neo-Aristotelianism. So like these people take bits of Aristotle and they create new theories out of it. And I want to give you an example of someone I also admire very much, the American philosopher now working in the UK, Nancy Cartwright. So she's a philosopher of science. She was Popper's replacement at LSE when Popper retired. So we're talking about someone with great stature. And she thinks that science today cannot be done without Aristotelian dynamis or potentialities. It's a great statement. So that doesn't mean that she does history of philosophy. It means that she takes some ideas from Aristotle and she builds a theory that is Nancy Cartwright's theory. So there are a lot of examples, especially not only in metaphysics, but virtue ethics, virtue epistemology, and so on and so forth, functionalism. All these theories of today have been built by using these nuggets, you know, of gold from the ancients. And look, these people cannot be accused of anachronism because they don't want to be historically accurate. They say, I get inspired, like Rapp says. So they're not to be accused of anachronism. On the other hand, you know, I can think of a difficulty with this approach, and I put it to you, and you can tell me what you think. The problem is that at the end, say you have Nancy Cartwright's theory of causal powers, and she said, well, I cannot do it without borrowing Aristotle's ideas. The theory at the end, is it like Nancy Cartwright's theory or Aristotle's theory, and who is who? How do we give Caesar what's Caesar's? Okay. So sometimes the problem with this approach is that the boundary between the source and the new theory is blurred, so it's not quite clear who says what, who thinks what. And so the problem is that sometimes we're not fair to these ancient thinkers. We don't give them credit, or we give them too much credit. I mean, it's a real problem here. I discuss this with my students as well. How is it that we read these ancient thinkers, we work with them in the right way? I come to the last approach, and I approach also the I'm slowly going towards the end of my lecture. So I want to say there is the fellow travelers approach, so standing on the shoulders of giants. There is the mining approach, like take the golden bits and leave the rest. And then there is another approach that I call a dialogical approach, and no wonder this is the one I like myself. So it is an approach according to which there is something that we and the philosophers of the past have in common. And what we have in common is that the job we do, to put it simply, like we are philosophers, and being philosopher is a profession. Like we do it in a certain way. Like, you know, being an engineer is a profession, or being a doctor is a profession. So in the same way, I think we philosophers are professionals. I think, you know, we don't give opinions about the world. We're technical people trained to do a certain job. And in this sense, we and the philosophers of the past have the same job, okay? So at a certain abstract meta level, we're doing the same thing. So of course there are differences, but what is important is what, and this is why it's dialogue, right? There are differences, but we can speak. It's like playing chess. You know, we can play chess with them because we know that they were playing chess, we play chess, we can play chess, even if there is an historical distance. We know the rules of the game, that's my point. So knowing the rules of the game, that is what it is to do philosophy, enables us to have a fruitful conversation which is people of the past. Of course, it's not that Plato actually speaks to us, but you know what I'm saying. You know, we can interrogate the past. We can interrogate this text and try to learn from them, but also like put our questions to them, get their answers, give our objections, get their objections, and so on and so forth. We can do this even across time because we have their texts. Now, of course, it's true that what is salient, what was important to them, maybe is different from what was important to us. So, for example, in the field of political theory or ethics, I think that there are a lot of things are different. We face certain difficulties that are completely alien to the ancient world. And I just want to put one on the table, you know, the presence more and more in our lives of artificial intelligence. That generates a lot of ethical puzzles, right? And the ancients didn't have them, for example. But think of another example. Think of physics or cosmology. Like, you know, we want to know what are the ultimate particles, if they are particles of reality. And we have built CERN, and we like split and split and split, trying to find what's the ultimate element from which the universe is built. What's the origin of the universe, and so on and so forth. And these are really the questions that ancient cosmologists were asking too. They didn't do it empirically. They didn't have CERN, but you know, the methodology was just the same. If I'm very passionate about an ancient philosopher called Anaxagoras, who was really splitting, you know, mentally particles as much as we try to split them at CERN. So I'm giving you these as examples to say that doing philosophy is a profession, is all a game. Like playing chess, and as long as we are in the game, we are players of the same game, we can do that with the ancients, and then we can learn from them, we can get enriched by playing the game with them. Fine, that sounds good. But again, one more thing that I want to put to your consideration. So what is it that we learn when we play this chess game, or when we have a dialogue with the ancients? And again, here opinions differ. I'm going to give you the views, and then the reasons, and then you can tell me in discussion what you think about them. So one of my colleagues in the UK, someone I also respect hugely, the British philosopher John Marenbone, thinks that we should approach the history of philosophy in an aesthetic way. So you really heard me correctly. It's like aesthetics. And what does he mean by aesthetics? I give you a quote because I think it's very beautiful. He says, it is an approach in which a work of historical philosophy is valued not because of the number of conclusions it proposes that we're likely to find well established and wish to accept, but because how well, how deeply, how broadly it goes about the task of thinking philosophically. People need, he says, to read the great philosophers of the past, who are few, and antiquated, in order to see how philosophy is done at its best. End of quote. So what does he mean? I think it means the following. We should look at the ancients, or in general, the great thinkers of the past, to learn how to think. So it doesn't matter which conclusions, which ideas they had, but they did their job. They did it well. They did it so well that like 2,500 years later, we're still reading Aristotle. So this guy knew how to do philosophy, right? You know. And according to John Marenbone, what is interesting is that you cannot teach philosophy with the manual. There is no manual. Like, I cannot give my students a manual, like a set of instructions. Do this, like, you know, these IKEA brochures? You know, you want to build a table, it just tells you step by step what to do. Well, and then you build the table. With philosophy, you can do that. You cannot give a person like this set of instructions and say, work it out, you know, build your argument, here are the instructions. Marenbone is saying that to learn how to build an argument, you have to see, that's why it's called aesthetic, you have to see another person doing it. So it's like becoming an artist, becoming a sculptor. All the great artists of the past were going to learn looking at other great artists. And so Marenbone thinks that's exactly what it is with philosophy. So we need to show our students, these great thinkers of the past, work building their arguments, and so they can see how it's done, and they learn by seeing. It's a little bit like bicycling, swimming, you know, it's the doing of the thing. And Marenbone thinks, in this sense, the ancient thinkers are super important in this enterprise of teaching philosophy, because these ancient thinkers really did it well. They did it so well, we'll still think about them. Who knows if in 2,500 years from now, someone will think about our work, okay? But we know that we think about them, so we know they were excellent players in the game, so that's why we should look at them. And I like that. I like that. I think it's good. I really think it's a good way of thinking about philosophy. I do think that I cannot teach my students how to build an argument with an IKEA manual. I have to show them texts that have arguments and then show them how it's done practically in some sense, okay? That is good, but there is something that I don't like in this approach, so I think we cannot just do that. This approach minimizes the value of the ideas, the value of the content, just as the ancients are good for the way, for looking at the way they did philosophy, for how they operated, but not for the achievements. Okay, so it's not the results that matter. It's just that they did their job well, and I think that's too little. So and also it seems to limit the value of the history of philosophy only to the teaching of philosophy. So history of philosophy is good for teaching students how to do philosophy, but I want to say history of philosophy is good for researching as well in philosophy. And so it's not just about looking at these ways the ancient did their work, but finding in them interesting ideas that we can put in dialogue with our interests. The methodology that the ancients did is not antiquated, but the content also is not all antiquated. There may be some things that are antiquated, but not all things are antiquated. So if we had more time, I'd like to tell you that essentialism is not antiquated. We spent a lot of time with the students here thinking about it as a non-antiquated theory. But there are also lots of examples. So I'm slowly concluding here, and I want to come back to an issue that I raised in the beginning. How much of this depends on which type of philosophy you do? So you probably are aware that there is this division, it's not so strong, but it still exists between the analytical way of doing philosophy and the continental way of doing philosophy. And the analytical way is supposed to be the one that is inimical to the history of philosophy. Remember, I started with that quotation from De La Rocca. But I want to tell you, this is unfair to analytic philosophy. I'm a professor of analytic philosophy, and I think that's unfair to us. I think analytic philosophy gives us, as the word itself says, means of analysis. So we can analyze this text and analyze them in their premises, in their reasoning steps, in their conclusions. We can understand them better. So understanding them better, it's a way of respecting this text. And so I think the analytic philosopher looking at ancient philosophy can do it with respect for antiquity and to illuminate the past. So it's not about taking from the past only what we like today, it's illuminating the past through conceptual analysis and then doing the job of philosophizing with these ancient guys. So this is all I have to say. I myself, as you probably understood already, I'm in the group of people who think that there is value in studying and also in researching and teaching history of philosophy, and particularly ancient philosophy. I think not everything that the ancients did is without fault, philosophically speaking. So there are, there are theories that are not as good as they could be. There are mistakes, even logical mistakes, that even the greats make. They're humans, right? So it's not that we should be, it's not a matter of faith. We should not just believe in the ancients. We should talk to them and find out what we really like about them. And so I'm in favor of the study of ancient philosophy for our students, for our universities, and I hope for investing in something that is important to human inheritance. Thank you very much indeed.
Sie hörten zur Debatte Dokumentierte Vielfalt hören, der Podcast der Katholischen Akademie in Bayern.